I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers. So instead of producing ink on paper, the machine makes actual objects made out of plastic. Bree started the company in 2009 with his partners Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer. Prior to starting MakerBot, Bree was a public elementary school teacher in Seattle, Washington, a puppeteer, and an artist. He also is one of the founders of NYC Resistor, a hacker collective located in Brooklyn. Bree's also a video podcast producer, TV host, and father. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is MakerBot?
So a MakerBot is a machine that can make you anything. It's a replicator. So let's say you want something, you can imagine it and design it, or maybe somebody else has made it and you can download it, and then you just print it out. So say you need a bottle opener, you just print one out, and then you're opening bottles.
It's made out of plastic that feels kind of like Legos. What kind of plastic is it?
Well, there's two kinds of plastic you can use in a MakerBot right now, and we're exploring more. We're looking for more things to print with. But you can use ABS or PLA. ABS is a really common plastic. It's what most of the plastic you have in your life is made out of. It's like it's the same thing that Lego's made out of. PLA is another plastic we use, and it's made from corn, and it is biodegradable, and when you make things out of it, it smells like waffles.
3D printers have been around for decades, but they are very expensive and hundreds of thousands of dollars and huge, but your printers cost roughly $1,300. What was the impetus for wanting to create a cheaper 3D printer?
Well, we really wanted one, and they were really expensive. And so we just used the materials we had at hand and the tools we had at hand. We have a laser cutter that we share, and we just kept trying. So we locked ourselves up in our hackerspace with literally two cases of ramen and a lot of Club Mate, which is a caffeinated beverage. And we basically just camped out there making prototype after prototype. And we'd been working all through the night for days.
What was the first object you made with your 3D printer when it finally worked?
Oh, we promptly printed out a shot glass and had drinks.
You promptly printed out a shot glass and then hopped on a plane to South by Southwest, which is a leading technology innovative conference in Austin. What did South by Southwest lead to, if anything, for you?
Well, you know, we had made 20 kits for people to have their own 3D printer. And we thought, okay, we'll sell 10, and then we'll have 10 to sell next month. And then, of course, we sold those, like, really quickly. Like, within 2 weeks, we had sold out of the thing we thought would take 2 months to sell. So the race was on.
Who buys these 3D machines?
You know, the people who buy 3D printers are a real mix, because you've got some, you know, you've got the obvious kind of engineers, hackers, programmer types that get them. And then you've got just ordinary people who live in the future who want to have a machine that can make anything so that when they need something, they don't have to go to the store. They can just print it out and have it.
It takes a little while for you to kind of get your hands around exactly what it is we're talking about. Maybe it's my failure of imagination, but it took me some time to actually understand, okay, well, this is a printer not producing ink, but actually making stuff.
Yeah, it's a replicator. It replicates your ideas into real objects. It makes things, your ideas, real. And, you know, we're used to being consumers. We're used to, you know, if we want a clock, we think, okay, well, where do I go shop for that? Mm-hmm. When you have a MakerBot, the world's different. You see the world through MakerBot glasses. You can actually print out glasses. But when you have a MakerBot, you think, okay, I need a clock. Well, maybe I'll MakerBot one. And in fact, a group of folks actually did collaborate, and they made a grandfather clock mechanism that's just beautiful and ticks and everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes open source robots that make plastic objects. You grew up in Ithaca, New York, and then moved to Seattle, Washington. What was your home life like? What did your parents do, for example?
You know, my dad is, he's a marketer. His website is brand.com, so he's been doing it for a while. And my mom does a bunch of stuff, including art.
How did you become interested in making things or tinkering? Do you remember, do you have early experiences of just being very hands-on?
You know, I got into tinkering when I went to go visit my Aunt Meredith, who at that time was married to a guy named Joe. And Joe, his job was every morning he'd wake up and I'd get into his pickup truck with him at like 4 a.m. in Boston. He knew all the trash routes. And we'd go on the trash routes before the trash men came. And we'd pick out all the good stuff. And then during the week, during the day, he would fix that stuff up and on the weekend sell it at a flea market. And that week, we picked up a couple bikes that were broken and put them together. And he made me feel like I knew, like he let me put things together and figure out how it worked so that at the end, it was really my bike. I'd put that bike together, even though I was like 7.
By the way, where does the name Bree come from?
So my name Bree is short for Bree Huspety, and it comes from my parents who were hippies at the time. Their yogi gave me that name.
Your parents were not in the technology field at all, but your grandfather was. He also made machines. What kind of work did he do?
So my grandpa had a company called High Speed Checkware in Ithaca. His company made machines that would weigh things really quickly. So when Morton salt comes down the production line in long lines of circular tubes, his machine would be on the line, and it would quickly weigh things. And if there wasn't enough salt in one of the containers, it would knock it off. So he made machines that would weigh things at a high speed.
When you were growing up in Seattle, you know, Bill Gates, Microsoft was pretty big. Did that have any impact on your thinking at all?
You know, Microsoft is something I had friends whose parents worked at Microsoft, and Bill Gates moved into the neighborhood. And I don't know so much one of the things that did affect me is I had a friend who worked at Nintendo, and Paul Scavlin had a job where his job was to play games all day. He was a tester, and then later on he was a game counselor, because back in those days you could call, if you didn't mind paying long distance, you could call up Nintendo and talk to somebody and be like, I can't get through this level, and they'd be like, go find the magic hammer and hit it this wall with it, mm-hmm, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And that was his job. And I remember thinking, oh, that's such a, you know, that's a job that somebody does. Like, that exists in the world. Like, mm-hmm. there's not just, like, you're going to be a doctor or a nurse or a farmer or something like this. There's people who play games for a living. I thought, okay, anything can happen.
How much was the notion of you're having to make a living, how large did that loom in your career choices, for example?
For me, in terms of my career, I've always felt really strongly to, you know, follow my heart. I read, you know, the whole Joseph Campbell Power of Myth series and was very inspired to follow my passion. And so you don't go into teaching to make money. I think after 7 years, I was making about $31,000 a year. But I was there because I wanted to create infrastructure for people to make things, to learn how to be creative. And that's been a thread through my whole life, the idea of creating infrastructure for people to be creative and being creative.
You've been a public school teacher, but what was your own education like?
You know, it was mixed. I mean, I dropped out of middle school because I just didn't want to go, and I was having to face bullies and get into fights all the time. So I just dropped out of seventh grade and was happy to do so. And then, you know, later on, I realized, like, okay, school, fine. I see how this works. I have to do this to make other things happen. Basically, I kind of got back into school when I was, like, a sophomore, and I realized, okay, I'll jump through the hoops to see if, to make sure I can make something else happen. And then I got lucky, and I ended up going to the Evergreen State College, which is it's a liberal arts college in Olympia, Washington, where there are no requirements except that you have to have X amount of credits before you can graduate. So you can study anything. I studied everything from political science and history to education and ethnomusicology and mythology and psychology, and ended up doing dance for 2 years and being in a samba band and playing gamelan. And so I was able to just continually explore different kinds of things and try different things out.
You talk about dropping out of school in seventh grade. So you're 12 years old. What does that mean? Like, you wake up in the morning and what do you do?
You know, as a kid, when you go to school and you're the first 6 months of school are full of intimidation and bullying, you just find a way to not go. You just wake up and you think, I'm not going.
Where'd you go? What'd you do?
I just stayed at home and read books.
What did your parents say?
It didn't matter. I wasn't going.
But what did they say?
I don't remember.
So they didn't have much choice.
No, I wasn't going.
What was the experience like for you of being an elementary school teacher in the public school system in Seattle? Was it as creative as you had hoped?
As a teacher, I got to be the art teacher, which is one of the last places you're actually not bound by teaching to the test in American public schools. And so I got to teach kids how to make things, how to sew a button. Most kids don't know how to sew a button onto if they lose a button. They don't know how to put it back. So there's kind of basic skills like that that are really satisfying and make young people feel really independent. But the bureaucracy and the underfundedness of schools these days means that really there's not enough resources to do to be effective as a teacher and with 32 kids in a classroom. It eventually wears you down. After being a school teacher for 7 years, I can honestly say, like, if you can, drop out of school. If you're somebody who can follow your passion and try things out and develop infrastructure for yourself, if you have that kind of discipline, find other ways to learn things.
So here you were, a frustrated art teacher, and you said, okay, I'm going to move to Brooklyn. Talk to me about that moment.
So there were a couple things that happened. I had come to New York on vacation, and I had seen some video art at an art gallery. And I said, this is neat. I want one. How much is this artwork? And they said, well, the DVD is $15,000. And I had that kind of like Picasso moment of like, yeah, I could do that. Mm-hmm. So I went back and I made a video, and that was an art video called the I Love You Project. And I took it around to galleries in Seattle, and I said, here's my video. I'm ready to display it. And they all liked it. But after, a month or two, it had been seen by like 4 people, and nothing had happened. So I was like, screw this. I'm putting it on the internet. And sure enough, after like a few months, like 50,000 people had watched it. And I was like, okay, that's more than Phil's Mariners Stadium, But I like this. I like this kind of attention. So I started making more videos. I made videos for my students. Next thing you know, I'm making videos for Make Magazine. Then I moved to New York, and where I continued to work on making videos for Make Magazine, worked for Etsy for a bit, and then quit that to start MakerBot.
Etsy being the online marketplace for handmade items. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot. We'll hear more from Bree coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers. So instead of producing ink on paper, the machine makes actual objects made out of plastic. Bree started the company in 2009 with his partners Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer. Prior to starting MakerBot, Bree was a public elementary school teacher in Seattle, Washington, a puppeteer, and an artist. He also is one of the founders of NYC Resistor, a hacker collective located in Brooklyn. You've been willing to expose yourself, your private life, to some extent, publicly, using the internet.
Sure.
And you've been blogging since 2004. And I'd love for you to read one of your blogs from 2004. It's entitled Dream. Okay.
Okay.
You're laughing. Why are you laughing?
Here we go. So I've been blogging for a long time. I actually had a blog in 99, but it was anonymous and I ended up erasing it. It's this idea of sharing what you're thinking. Okay. And then I got at one point in 2004, I was like, okay, I'm just going to share everything, including my dreams. So I just woke up from a dream that involved going to the transmission shop, driving to a farm owned by my brother, enjoying the farm, and then falling from a pulley cable slide. My brother was played by Tom Hanks, and when I fell, I began screaming incoherently, and I was paralyzed with a plastic sword in each hand. Even though I was screaming inside, I knew the tragedy because I would die and I would miss out on marrying the love of my life, and I would miss my brother, and all the things I want to do would never be done. Tom Hanks carried me through 3 feet deep of water, and I was still screaming in my dream as I woke up. My dream reflected a few things to me. First of all, I love my brother and I love having a brother. Secondly, I touched on a deep sadness in me. I've experienced loss and I can touch that sadness in myself. I've been having a lot of dreams lately. Feels like a time of change in my life. My modus operandi has been to go with the flow and accept the events and things that come to me in life and nurture those opportunities. I've changed a little now in that I am searching to build something. I'm searching for a path that I can set out on. No more hitchhiking through life. I want to drive my own train.
How do you feel reading that now?
You know, one of the nice things about having a blog is that you leave breadcrumbs for yourself to say, like, okay, this is where I'm at now. And so I can see then in 2004, I wanted to start making things happen more. I wanted to be like, okay, let's do things. You know, I think this is a little bit of a moment where you can see, like, okay, I wanted something, but I didn't know what. It took me a few years to get to a place where I'm quite happy driving things.
You talk about being deeply sad. What made you deeply sad at that point in your life?
I don't know, actually. Not sure.
What is your feeling about, you know, sharing your personal life and
So when I first started making videos, I was video blogger, like, number 13 in this early crew of video bloggers. And I was making videos for my students, and I was making personal videos, and I was sharing them. And we grew this community of, like, 25 or 30 people. And we were just making videos that were, like, let me show you my apartment. And people weren't doing this at the time, so it felt like, okay, we're in this club of people who are sharing, you know, look at what my cat did today. And it sounds kind of silly to say today because YouTube is just absurdly full of this kind of stuff. But back then, it really felt like we're breaking new ground. We're finding new ways to share. And sharing is really important to me. It's one of those things where, if you are not somebody who shares, you should be, because there's a future out there that is sadder if you don't. We're in a nice time where just in the past few years, sharing has become something that has value. You know, and even if you just share stories about how you dealt with something or how you got your baby to sleep at night or whatever, it means you're leaving breadcrumbs for other people so they won't feel as alone, so that when they go to learn how to do something, they can build on what you did and take it to the next level.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers that produce plastic objects. You moved to Brooklyn in 2007, and prior to starting MakerBot, you were one of the creators of NYC Resistor, which is a hacker collective, which allows people to tinker with software and technology. But the word hacker kind of has this negative connotation that, like, you're invading somebody else's technology. What was the purpose of this hacker collective in Brooklyn?
So NYC Resistor is a really special place. You enter it and there's a laser cutter. There's a big table where there's lots of people working on their laptops. There's soldering irons where people are assembling electronics. There's, you know, all sorts of tools and materials. A member of NYC Resistor can make anything. Our motto is we learn, share, and make things. When people think about hacker, a lot of times they think about, like, oh, somebody's breaking into my computer. But I believe a hacker is somebody who's got a special enthusiasm for figuring out how things work and using them in special ways. An example of somebody who, when we first started, we came out, our first model 3D printer was the Cupcake. It was inexpensive, it worked, and it was great. But it was our first machine, so there was a lot of room for improvement. Because we shared all the designs, people could hack on it. They could improve it. And they did. They built all these crazy adaptations. They took the Z stage, which is the part that goes up and down. They ripped the back off it. They put their own one on. And they could do that because they could print out replacement parts that improved the machine. Mm-hmm. And every time this happened, we celebrated it. We were like, cool, this person found a way of taking what we did and improving on it, mm-hmm, and sharing back with the community.
You met Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer, your co-founders of MakerBot, at NYC Resistor, and you decided you wanted to make a go of this as a company, and you raised $75,000 from friends and family initially, and that $75,000 turned into $5 million of revenue. Were you surprised by the level of demand for this?
Yeah, I mean, we started it off and we were like, okay, this, when we started, we kind of fooled ourselves thinking, yeah, we'll just start this. This will be something we do. Maybe we'll do other stuff too. And then as soon as we sold the first 20 in no time flat, we were like, okay, now we got to make more. Mm-hmm. And so we spent that first 3 months prototyping and getting ready, and then we launched our product. Then we spent the next like 9 or 10 months just figuring out how to pack and ship and put labels on things and count out nuts and bolts and stuff like this.
How are you supporting yourself at the time financially?
Oh, we were broke. We weren't paying ourselves. Every time we got, you know, money, we were spending it on robot parts. I skipped rent 1 month just because I didn't have it. We're a committed group. We were really into it.
To what extent did being broke scare you?
Well, being broke sucks. It means you can't take your girlfriend out to dinner, and it's pretty stressful. But it, you know, to counter that, we knew we were onto something, and we had to ride it as hard as we could and push it as hard as we could so we can get as many of them out there and change the world.
You talk about being broke while you were trying to get the company off the ground, and it was hard to not be able to take your girlfriend out to dinner. Your girlfriend at the time became your eventual partner and the mother of your child. How did you meet Keo Stark?
We met playing Werewolf, which is a game where you try and use deceit and lying to survive in a town of werewolves. And this is a real-life game. It's not online. And together you are a village, and you have to figure out – and there's werewolves in the village, and you have to figure out who they are, except you don't know who they are because they look like people. So you have to figure out who's lying.
Was either of you a werewolf?
Absolutely not. We were both villagers. I met Keo, and we were talking about trying to effectively lie, trying to come up with strategies for that, and Keo's a horrible liar. And so that was a nice way to kind of start with an honest moment about deception, I guess.
Is there a community of werewolf players out there somewhere?
Werewolf is one of those games that's gotten popular on like conferences. Mm-hmm. So after the conference, you'll get like 10 or 12, 15 people together and a bunch of drinks, and you'll sit around and lie to each other, see if you can figure out who's lying.
Keo is an author, and she recently wrote a novel called Follow Me Down. She's also written a manual, a handbook called Don't Go Back to School.
Keo did a lot of interviews with people to figure out how they learned things without going to school. Mm-hmm. So it's all about how to learn things without having to pay for it.
You've created with Keo a manifesto of sorts called The Cult of Done. How do you live your life, or how do you express this cult of done?
There's some things like, you know, if you have an idea and you don't execute it within a week, throw it away. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. Abandon it. Then there's things like done is the engine of more. So when you finish something, it means you can do more. So finish more things so you can start more things. Another one is like everything is a rough draft. Don't strive for perfection. Just get it to a place where you're satisfied.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes open-source robots that make plastic objects. MakerBot's 3D printers produce objects used for designing, recreation, and practical life. So things like bathtub plugs, shower curtain rings, bottle openers. A MakerBot printer costs roughly $1,300. I want to talk some more about the varied applications of some of the objects that MakerBot produces.
Sure.
For instance, somebody made an engagement ring out of a MakerBot machine. What's that story?
So there's a guy named Finnflood, and he was going to Iceland the next day with his sweetie. And he thought, you know, it's Friday night, and he thought, maybe this would be a great time. This would be a beautiful place. Maybe I'll find a beautiful place to go and pop the question. But I need a ring, and it's late, and I'm leaving tomorrow. So he popped down to his local hackerspace and printed one out, and they went to Iceland, and he gave it to her, and she said yes. And it's a really nice story because it means, like, you can have a MakerBot and print out anything, really.
That's one small example, but do you have, like, a larger mission or hope for the company? I mean, here's somebody who makes, you know, an engagement ring, but What does this look like on a larger scale? Or it might just be like you just want people to make stuff.
Well, when we started, we saw those first 20 machines and we thought, okay, here's potential energy. This is going out there and people are going to use these machines to make anything they want. And now that we've got, goodness, 7,000 machines are out in the wild right now, 7,000 MakerBots, we're seeing what people are doing. Every day there's new things that people are making. You know, they're making cookie cutters, they're making robots, they're making characters, they're making remote control cars. The thing that's getting me excited these days is what will we do together? What can 7,000 MakerBots in the world do? One of the projects we're working on right now is called Project Shelter. We're making shells for hermit crabs because hermit crabs are facing a housing shortage. So we're helping them.
What's wrong with the shells of hermit crabs now?
Hermit crabs don't make their own shells. And humans take them away from the beach, and the snails that make the shells that hermit crabs like are not producing as many shells. So they're doing things like sticking their butts in bottles and sticking their butts in shotgun shells and stuff like this, and that's just wrong. People have uploaded different designs for shells because hermit crabs are kind of picky, and it works. The community collectively are solving an ecological problem.
What are other examples?
When Deepwater Horizon, the catastrophe that happened in the Gulf where they were drilling and oil was just flooding into the Gulf, the Thingiverse community rallied together to try and figure out, okay, what's the problem? How can we help? I'm really curious as the community grows to see what will, not just what will one printer do, but what will 7,000 printers and their users do to change the world together.
What is the Thingiverse?
Thingiverse is a universe of things. It's a place to share your digital designs. So you can, if you design something, say you design a new type of bottle opener, you can upload it and share it and everybody can benefit.
Another project that you've worked on in the past is an art project where you exhibited works of art made by MakerBot at the New Museum in New York City. Talk to me about that project.
Yes.
This was a project that you did with Zach Lieberman.
Yeah. So Zach Lieberman and I went to Tompkins Square Park and we took strangers and we set them down and we asked them to tell them who are the important people in your life. Immediately it got good when people talk to you about who they care about and share the people who are important to them. They get emotional. And we caught that on video and we caught that with a 3D scanner. And then we printed out miniature heads about 4 inches tall of the people who had done this. And then we projected images of them talking on it. So in some ways, it was kind of like, that moment in Star Wars where Princess Leia goes, "Help me, Obi-Wan. You're my only hope." And she's in 3D and she's projected. It was kind of like that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes 3D printers. Speaking of the important people in your life, you became a father in 2011, and in the spirit of sharing your life on the internet, you talked about the hardship that you faced when your daughter was born prematurely, and she was in the NICU for a couple of months. You blogged or wrote about one particular incident when she was in the NICU and no one was paying attention.
Yeah.
Can you describe that experience briefly?
So hospitals suck. The internet hasn't arrived to hospitals. And the way that data gets transferred at hospitals is people work 12 hours because they're two 12-hour shifts. And then they stay a little bit longer than their 12 hours because the next person comes on shift. And they share everything that they've done in the last 12 hours with the next person. And that's the way that data transfer happens in a hospital. So I had a baby named Nika, and she was born 7 weeks early, which is really early, and she was 2.5 pounds. So she had to go to the NICU, which is where they put babies in little boxes and watch them. And the second night I came back, because they don't let you be there from, I think it's 8 to 9, because that's their transition time where they're expected to share the data. And I arrived at 9, and the monitors were flatlined, which means there's no heartbeat, no breathing, no oxygen. And I was like, okay, before I completely freak out, I'm just going to check. And so I went over and I checked her pulse and I checked her breathing, and she was breathing and there was a pulse. And I started looking at, and I looked at the monitor, and it was clear it hadn't been hooked up for 2 hours. Hmm. And so I asked the nurse, I said, you know, this is why my baby hasn't been hooked up for 2 hours. And rather than saying, oh, I'm sorry, let me fix this right now, this is horrible, she proceeded to make excuses about how overworked they were, how the technology isn't reliable, how the backup systems hadn't been in effect, and how hard it was to find good people.
Making excuses.
Making lots of excuses. And if she had just said, I'm going to fix this right now, would have been fine. But making excuses meant that these, you know, four layers of redundancy had all failed, and I was the only one who'd noticed it. And I'm sure parents who are listening can imagine, you know, when you're trust your baby to someone else and they don't let you be there. I was just, I got really mad.
Anything that a MakerBot could fix?
You know what, though? When I was in the NICU, I was there for 6 weeks and I basically camped out there. And I looked at all the technology there. The isolette, which is the box that the baby's in, that also has a bunch of hookups and stuff like this for it, and has air that you can pump in. You know, that costs like a lot of money, like $75,000 for that box. And I'm thinking, okay, I could do that for three and maintain all the functionality.
$3,000.
Yeah. What I did in my 6 weeks of the NICU was just sit there and reverse engineer all the stuff in the hospital, thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe they pay this much for it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot. Coming up, we'll meet Alex Counts, founder and president of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Oh, no. Oh, Lord, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to make loans to small business owners in almost 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Alex founded the Grameen Foundation in 1997 after working with the pioneer of microfinance, Muhammad Yunus, at the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Alex is the author of Small Loans, Big Dreams. Welcome.
Thank you.
What does Grameen mean?
Grameen, actually, many people think it's the name of the founder of the bank. And in fact, it is just a word in the Bengali language, which roughly translates as rural or village. And Grameen Bank was set up in Bangladesh to fill the gaps in lending. And one of the gaps were there wasn't nearly enough lending in the rural areas and the villages. So that led to the name evolving as the Grameen Bank.
Now, Muhammad Yunus is considered the pioneer of microfinance. What form did microfinance have prior to his coming on the scene?
Well, I think, you know, there's always been lending to people who wouldn't qualify for whatever the traditional lending, bank lending of that era was. People can go back to biblical times. But institutionalizing it, the way I think of it is Ray Kroc didn't invent the hamburger, but he did something with it that no one ever done before. The founder of McDonald's. But Dr. Yunus didn't invent lending to the poor, but he actually institutionalized it, franchised it, if you will, in a way that no one had ever done.
When did you first learn about microfinance or about Muhammad Yunus?
When I was at Cornell in the mid-80s, one of the things very striking of that era was there was a lot of student protest. It was Reagan administration, liberal campus, and people were protesting apartheid. And I just saw that I got no energy from working against things I didn't like. And through a series of discussions with mentors, I said, I want to find out on issues of poverty and injustice, what was working in the world. Dr. Yunus and Grameen Bank came onto my radar screen, and it all started with a letter I wrote him my junior year, where I basically kind of laid out how I thought I could help him expand on a global scale.
What exactly did the letter say?
Well, it's I'm sure if I could dig the letter up from his files, I'd be embarrassed by it in many ways, because I think I more or less proposed what must have sounded like the Eunice Count's plan to eradicate global poverty. Very simplistic and grandiose, and saying that I'd figured something out over beer and pizza one night in my, you know, on the campus, which is that if Grameenbank could be applied in all the countries where poverty was pervasive, that you could really start to roll back global poverty. And despite the oversimplification and kind of grandiosity of it, he wrote me back. And he told me that I should first come and learn everything about Grameen, and I should try to learn the language of Bangladesh before I got there. And I was so encouraged that he took the time to write me back that that's exactly what I did.
Were you surprised to get the letter back from him, or were you like, yeah, of course, it's a good idea?
I was pretty surprised. What I was more surprised with is not that he replied, but he really took my idea seriously. And he saw the germ of something really good within me, and I think that's his secret. I think when he walks into a village, you know, he looks at a beggar woman and he sees a businesswoman, and so helps bring out of people their highest potential. So when he saw me reaching probably much farther than I had any right to about what I could do addressing global poverty, he saw in me that even without ever looking me in the eye that I could do it, and of course that set me and, you know, got me very excited.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. So you get a reply from Muhammad Yunus, and he says, come to Bangladesh. So after graduation, you hopped on a plane, and what happens next?
Well, I've been fortunate. Both Cornell had a very dynamic language program, so I picked up some Bengali before I got there, which surprised everyone. And it was interesting because I went on a Fulbright scholarship, and there were delegations from the U.S. Embassy and Grameen Bank that went to pick me up. And I had a choice right there, what lifestyle, and I went with the Grameen folks. And for my first year there, I had almost no contact with Americans. I immersed myself in everything Grameen and really became an insider there.
What do you remember specifically? What are some examples of that year? Things that surprised you?
Yeah.
Things that weren't as set up as well as you thought? Or,
well, I think that when I first went out to the villages with Professor Yunus, how he was regarded as something of a kind of a savior, a hero in rural Bangladesh, and the closeness of the loan officers. You know, Dr. Yunus once said to me that if a branch manager who's been in his post for a year doesn't know the names of all the children of the 1,500 borrowers and their husbands' names, then he isn't doing his job, because he's just basically doing a transaction. He's not taking the interest he needs to in their overall well-being. But really, when I saw how, and my language skills got good enough to really draw out of women in conversations how they turn $40 or $60 loan to do something as simple as make cottage cheese and sell it to the shops in Dhaka. When I could draw that out of people in one-on-one conversations, I said, there's something about this that it's so elegant, so simple, and works well. And so that was very striking, that, again, banking, but so much more.
You started Grameen Foundation in 1997. Mm-hmm. Professor Yunus is on the board. And he gave you or lent you $6,000?
Well, what he did do is, around the time that we were setting it up, he had won a prize. But while he was waiting to bring the money into Bangladesh, he had earned some interest in an interest-bearing account. So he gave me the interest. Huh. And he said, this is your seed money to start Grameen Foundation. And so we turned that somehow or other into $100,000 in the first year. So like many things associated with Grameen, it started very small, but it ends up being pretty substantial.
How old were you in 1997 when you started Grameen Foundation?
I had just turned 30.
What were some of the kind of important stepping stones in those in that critical early period, like some important turning points for you?
To begin with, I really wasn't a good fundraiser at all. So a couple times we almost ran out of money. At one point, our auditor told us that our bank balance was down to $200, and I had like 6 or 7 staff at the time. So we were that close to being insolvent. A couple times I didn't even pay myself a salary for 3-4 months in a row, so we didn't run out of money. But I met kind of fortuitously in early 2000 I had a number of microfinance leaders who were applying the Grameen methodology in India, and they said, we need $1 million. And if you give us $1 million at the end of the year, we'll do great things. We can add more than 100,000 borrowers, but we need that up front. And this was what we were set up to do, but I was so intimidated, I was barely able to keep the lights on at the time. And I joined forces with Steve Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller's grandson, who said he was willing to help me, and we literally raised $1 million in 3 weeks.
How did you meet Steve Rockefeller?
I was invited at the time. Bankers Trust, which later became part of Deutsche Bank, was setting up a microfinance fund, kind of a quasi-commercial, quasi-philanthropic fund. And they were looking for someone new to the field. And so they asked me if I was willing to join the board as an advisor. And he was on the board. And we hit it off. A little mesmerized by his charisma and the name, I said, that's a fun guy I'm going to try to call and have coffee with. And within a year or so, that concrete project came on. I was panicked about how we were going to ever meet this goal. And I got up my courage to ask him to help me, and he said yes. It was really during that time with Steve's mentorship that I found my voice as a fundraiser. And one of the things I realized is that I was giving these wealthy people an opportunity to be part of something really important for meaning, for accomplishment that they wouldn't be able to have without me. And suddenly fundraising went from trying to take something from someone and leaving them with less, but really realizing that we're doing a deal with them, we're leaving them with more. Yeah. And I never looked back.
You had another turning point after raising $1 million with the help of Steve Rockefeller a couple years later, where you built your first credit facility, where you created leveraged pools of capital. You were able to raise roughly $30 million, which then could be leveraged to $140 million to loan. What was the catalyst for that?
Well, actually, if I mentioned earlier that I raised $1 million with Steve Rockefeller, and we set out to raise $1 million the following year, and we weren't able to do that. We raised only a quarter of that amount for India. This was 2001. The economy had contracted and after the 9/11 attacks. So we were trying to scratch our heads. How do we get more leverage out of a reduced amount? And people thought about, what if we use the money we raised to give some sort of a partial guarantee to Indian banks to lend to these micro-lending organizations, lend them $1 million, and they could then use that to give out a lot of $100 loans, and we would be a kind of a partial guarantor because we had reduced amount of capital. And it actually worked. We used $250,000 to leverage $2.5 million. So that planted a seed of, my God, we're on to something here. And it might be not just in India. So we did a kind of a long shot. We pulled all these people together in the home of a venture capitalist, John Doerr. Founded Clarence Perkins, was one of the early investors in Amazon and many of the really great West Coast companies, legendary venture capitalist. And people said, well, what could we actually do now that we've learned about the possibilities of microfinance? And he said, well, I'm told by the Grameen staff that if we were to collectively pledge 0.1% of our net worth, not give it, but pledge it to this loan guarantee pool, they could bring tens of millions of dollars, and probably we would never need to give them a cent, but we need to be willing to lose that amount. And that, people said, well, I might be willing to do that. And so it took us 10 months once we got the mandate from this group, but we were able to put together the facility, and they pledged collectively $31 million, and that allowed us over 5 years, where we were able to leverage more than $150 million, and there was not a single default, and it's funded on more than 1 million microloans.
And you had this meeting at John Doerr's house 8 days after your father died. Talk to me about the intensity of that period.
Well, it was, this is something we'd been building towards. A fundraising colleague, Barb Weber, also a good friend, put it together, and it was so improbable. We weren't on that strong financial footing at the time, Grameen Foundation. My father's health was uncertain, and I wasn't even sure I was able to go. It was the meeting that had been years in the planning, and yet somehow we pulled it off. And what was interesting was I found myself so kind of emotionally depleted, having just come from my father's funeral, and that one or two of my staff and one of my board members really took up the leadership role I play. I was very much in the background, and so it was a very complex, exciting negotiation with these, you know, 25 individuals who were there, and one that I just got to kind of sit back and observe the team that I'd assembled negotiate that with some of the people, the leaders of industry, and yet doing it really as peers, and that was thrilling.
Grameen Bank and Grameen Foundation is creating ancillary benefits other than simple poverty reduction, for example, decrease in domestic violence or a dissipation of, let's say, Hindu-Muslim conflicts. What are some examples of that?
When I was researching my book, Small Loans, Big Dreams, I met a woman, Amina Begum, who was one of the newest recruits in that village. And one of the things that was really striking is that, well, she had been didn't own any of her own land, nor did her husband, and so she was quite entrepreneurial, raising chickens and livestock, and yet as we learned and we interviewed her over time, sometimes when her husband wasn't there, that she said that her husband, frustrated with their poverty, had often taken in the past to beating her, and actually showed a place where she'd been beaten with a bicycle chain and a scar under her chin that wasn't easily visible. And yet she explained this story that once she joined Grameen, she'd kind of gone into a little bit of a agreement with her other borrowing members who said they were going to come by. And knowing that the husband really liked having the working capital for the businesses that they went in together, that they told the husband kind of off the cuff that Grameen had a rule that if there was any abuse and beating in any household, that the loan capital was immediately cut off, which wasn't actually a rule. But they kind of scared him, and from that moment forward, that he neither beat her nor the children because he was afraid of losing the access to that capital. I thought about this village where there was a lot of centuries of the Hindus and Muslims living peacefully together, but in recent decades getting more tense, especially as there were conflicts within India, where it's a Hindu majority, and many of the Hindus that were a little more prosperous were leaving and migrating to India, and it was really leaving a hole in the social fabric of this village, Kolshi, in Bangladesh, which was the name of the village. And yet when Grameen came in and started forming these solidarity groups, borrowing groups, the only way you could do it in most cases was to have groups that were both Hindus and Muslims together, women. And they began to socialize more and establish, you know, bonds of friendship. And what was interesting is that when I went back 10 years later to this village in Bangladesh where I'd lived and worked and was researching my book, is that more or less from that time onward, when Grameen had been around for a few years, the whole flight of the Hindus to India had stopped.
What is the default rate among the people you're lending to?
Except in cases of immediately after a natural disaster, typical default rates are 2-3%. So basically the same, more or less the same on commercial loans in the United States.
What percent of the recipients are women?
If you look at the organizations that Grameen Foundation supports, the majority of them are 100% women borrowers. And of the rest, it's anywhere between 50-90%. Microlending and the research shows this, and my own personal journeys to slums and villages is that the women make better credit risks. They also use the profit to help give the children of the next generation the best chance to emerge from poverty by investing in health and education and nutrition of that next generation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there ever any stigma or trouble that results or resentment among the men because the women are receiving sometimes 100% of microfinance credit?
There's often tension. In fact, in many villages, one that I spent a lot of time in Bangladesh, the men in the village for 6 months didn't allow Grameen to operate. They said, we don't think this is a right kind of bank if you only lend to women. And so Grameen said, well, we'll wait around for a little while, but ultimately we'll just pull up stakes and go. And the men were like, well, this is the only place to get credit at a fair rate. And if you have this crazy policy about lending to women, I guess that's okay. And so, you know, there is tension, and then sometimes there's tension within the family. The man wants to use the loan for another different purpose than the woman applied for it. And this is where the group solidarity comes in, where if a woman is approached by her husband to divert the loan to another purpose, she goes and gets her friends in her borrowing group, and they come and try to convince the husband. And if that doesn't work, they bring the other women bring their husbands. And if that doesn't work, you bring the staff from the bank so that the money goes into the productive uses that everyone agreed with. One of the things that men, if you talk to men who have had their women come into microfinance, is they'll say something like, I had no idea that my wife had this ability in business. And when she started working in business and earning income, it took pressure off me to have to provide for all the needs of the family. And it was a little shocking to see that part of her come out. But the microloan made it possible. And I saw a whole new side to my wife that I'd never seen before.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that makes loans to small business owners across the globe. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.